Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. A memoir of hope, healing, and survival, sure to resonate with the fans of J.C. Dugard's A Stolen Life and Elizabeth Smart's My Story. On August 28, 1997, just as she was starting her junior year at the University of Kentucky, Holly Dunn and her boyfriend, Chris Meyer, were walking along railroad tracks on their way home from a party when they were attacked by notorious serial killer Angel Maturino Resendez, a.k.a. the Railroad Killer. After her boyfriend is beaten to death in front of her, Holly is stabbed, raped, and left for dead. In this memoir of survival and healing from a horrific true crime, Holly recounts how she lived through the vicious assault, helped bring her assailant to justice, and ultimately found meaning and purpose through service to victims of sexual assault and other violent crimes. She has worked as a motivational speaker, an activist, and founded Holly's House, a safe and nurturing space in her hometown of Evansville, Indiana. The book that we're featuring this evening is Soul Survivor, the inspiring true story of coming face to face with the infamous railroad killer, with my special guest author, speaker, and founder of Holly's House, Holly Dunn. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Holly Dunn.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you very much. Incredible story, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview. This is very, very personal, I know, and the only thing is I know that you've probably told this more than most victims have ever told their story. It's the only probably difference. Let's get right into this. Tell us a little bit about your growing up. You talk about your father being a successful businessman, and you admired him. Tell us a little bit about your early life before we talk about how you happened to meet Chris Meyer.
Sure. My early life was amazing. I had a wonderful childhood. I had two great loving parents. I had a sister that I grew up with. And, you know, we lived a great life. We went to school. We went on vacations. I had a perfect childhood. If you could have had a perfect childhood, I think I had it.
Right. And you say your dad was he owned a bunch of hotels, and so you were you were trying to follow in his footsteps, and you were trying to do studies in accounting. Tell us a little bit about your schoolwork and where you, and a little bit about your father's business and your aspirations as well.
Sure. Sure. So I had always planned to go into business with my father. Well, later in life, that kind of was my plan. I studied accounting, then finance at the University of Kentucky. And, that was my plan. I was going to go into business with him, maybe someday take over the business. That was kind of my thought. I never thought I would get married. I never thought I would have kids. That was my plan. I just always had career goals. And so I was just going to, get my degree and then go and work for my father. So, and his business is, we franchise hotels. So it's called Dunn Hospitality Group. And we actually, own and manage and build hotels, kind of in Indiana and Kentucky and in a probably a 500 mile radius from Evansville. So it's been a successful business. And I think what I always saw in my father that I wanted to emulate was that he was able to be in our lives. Like, he came to all my basketball games. He came to, when I had things at school, he came to dinner every night. I liked that he was so much a part of our family, but he was a successful businessman. So I think that's really what I wanted to emulate, is I wanted to be, if I did end up having a family, I wanted to have a great career, but then also be able to have, you know, time with my family.
You also grew up in a, not a strict Catholic family, but a serious Catholic family. Tell us a little bit about the faith that you grew up in.
Sure. Well, my mom was Catholic, and so I grew up Catholic. I went to Catholic school. My dad was actually General Baptist, though. And so my dad would go to his church, and my mom and dad would both go to each other's churches. So my dad would go to church with my mom and with us, and then we would also go to my dad's church. So we were going to a lot of times to church ceremonies every weekend. And, you know, that it made me probably very well-rounded in my Christianity. I think I learned a lot about the Baptist faith as well as a lot about the Catholic faith, but I was baptized Catholic and raised Catholic.
Now let's get to where you are in 97. You talk about that you had rented an apartment with a couple of your friends off campus, a second floor of a house, and you were going to the University of Kentucky at Lexington. So this is June 97. So tell us the circumstances of where you were in your life at that time. We just talked about how things were great up to this point anyway. And
sure.
In continuing with that, in June 97 at Kentucky, and you meet University of Kentucky, you meet Chris Mayer. Tell us a little bit about Chris and how you came to meet him that fateful day.
Sure. So I was going to summer school at the University of Kentucky. I was trying to catch up on some classes that summer, and I was taking summer school. So I was living in an apartment off campus and going to summer school. And I met Chris one night, you know, in the middle of summer school. I mean, my roommate was actually turning 21, and so we wanted to go out and get her a drink for her birthday, but I was not yet 21, so we just went to a restaurant where she would be able to get, you know, a drink at a restaurant. But
right.
We went to, I guess, we went to a restaurant that wouldn't serve us because I wasn't 21 yet. And so we were kind of deflated. We were like, well, we're going to go home and she's not going to get her birthday drink. You know, we went at midnight, actually on her birthday. And we ended up stopping by a bar close to where we were living. And it was crazy because it was a laundromat, but there was a bar next to it. And that's actually where I met Chris that night. It was the, you know, after midnight on my friend's birthday, and we were just trying to buy her a drink, and Chris and all of his friends were sitting at that bar, and I guess very familiar with it. I had never been in it before, but that's where we met. And, you know, we started talking straight away, and I think it was kind of, we were smitten with each other, I think, that night. And so that just started it all.
As you describe them, because it's important anyway, but can you describe them for people to get a visual of what he was like and also what he looked like, but also what he was like? You mentioned the band Fish and sort of his, he was a bike enthusiast. So what did you first deduce from talking to him and learn about him and attracted you to him? And also describe kind of what he looks like for our audience.
Sure. So Chris was 6'5", so he was quite tall, and he was an outdoorsy kind of guy. So he enjoyed, you know, you could tell in the way that he dressed, just in his demeanor, that he loved the outdoors. That he was, you know, just not he didn't have a lot of material things that he cared about. But he was the kindest soul. Such an amazing guy, gave great big bear hugs. He was friendly to everyone he met. And you know, just the kindest soul. And you know, that he never met a stranger. Like, he was friendly to everyone. And you know, so he was super, a super attractive guy, but also just super friendly. And everyone wanted to be his friend because he was just a kind, nice, good guy. And you know, that's I'm sure that's what drew me to him. And you know, I hadn't met a guy like him before, so I think that, you know, that's what drew me to him in the first place.
Now you're both in classes, and so your relationship develops. And so, tell us how long it is before You get into this situation one evening, and before we talk about that, tell us about the process of your relationship and where you were at before on this day that everything changes.
Well, we were at a point in our relationship where we'd been dating for about 3 months. We hadn't been very serious in that 3 months. We had kind of become more friends.
Right.
And we had just gotten to a point, I think, in that 3 months where we were ready to take it a little further. We were ready to kind of be more than just friends.
Right.
You know, that happened maybe a week before the fateful night that happened to us. But so that we were, you know, actually wanting to take it further and wanting to get closer and wanting to develop the relationship. We'd only really known each other for 3 months. It wasn't long enough. Like if I had one wish, I wish that I could have spent more time with him, because I didn't get to, you know, we didn't even get to do anything that we had planned to do. You know, we had planned to, go on a picnic the next day and to, go hiking and go on a picnic. And, you know, we never got to do that. So I've tried to, I think that's what I've done in my life is that and that's what I did. That was a big part of my healing and how I had to grieve Chris was to actually, you know, go and do things that he loved and do things that he did. And I think that was actually part of my healing process. I think, you know, it wasn't a conventional way of healing, but for me, it was to go and do things that he loved and to live out things that he loved in his life so that I could know him better, because I didn't get long enough with him.
You talk about after his trip to Maine, because that'll be important a little bit later, but there's a party, this off-campus party here, and 40 or 50 people, and you go with your friends Adrian and a couple of friends of Chris's. So tell us about this party that you guys plan on, and then what happens that you get, did you come to happen to go for a walk, the four of you?
Sure. So we went to a party, and it was an off-campus party. It was maybe three blocks from campus. It was actually in a house that Chris had lived in before, the year before, so he knew that the area well. And he was in a fraternity. So it was actually right after fraternity recruitment had just ended. They'd gotten all their new members, and so they were having a party to celebrate that they had all their new members in the fraternity. So that's what the party was for. And when we got there, it was quite boring. There wasn't a whole lot of people there. I didn't know anyone there. And so, you know, myself and Chris and two of his fraternity brothers, actually went to take a walk. And we went to take a walk on down from the house. It was about, I don't know, maybe a block or two from the house that we went to the railroad tracks. And the railroad tracks were only probably three blocks from the house. And again, I said, Chris knew this area. So Chris had been to the railroad tracks before. And so we actually, you know, went to the tracks, and we were going to go put quarters down on the track and have trains run over them and flatten the quarters. And that was our thought, was that we all four went there, and we went and put coins on the tracks, and we waited, and we waited for a train to come by. And that was what we waited. We kept waiting and just waiting that, you know, and no trains came by. And so it was boring. That was more boring than the party. And I guess Chris and I were being kind of lovey-dovey. And so he actually, our friends went back to the party, and Chris and I stayed by the tracks to talk.
And while you're there, you don't notice anything amiss, but there's an electrical box, and you're talking, and again, you're just having a great time. And tell us what happens, what comes out of the dark.
So we get up to leave, and we're walking back toward the house where the party is. And as we get up to leave, a man comes out from behind an electrical box right next to the tracks. And he comes out, and he has a weapon on Chris, which I didn't even realize he had a weapon on Chris, but it was a knife or an ice pick, something sharp that he had on Chris. And so he asked for money. And, you know, I didn't really think anything of it, because I didn't see the weapon at this point. I thought, this is just somebody asking for money. Now, it was like midnight. It was dark. It was night. You know, there were strange things about it, but literally it was that a guy was asking us for money. And we said we didn't have any money, and he didn't believe us. So he had Chris get down on his knees and started going through Chris's backpack. So I thought, well, he's going through Chris's backpack to find the if we have any money. And he goes through Chris's backpack, or at least that's what he said he was doing, or that's what I thought he was doing. But really what he was doing, he was tying up Chris's hands behind his back with the backpack. And then he came over to me, and that's when I realized that he had a weapon. I mean, I wasn't far from him, but again, it was dark. And that's when I realized he had a weapon, and he held it up to me, and he took off my belt and tied my hands behind my back with my belt. And I think that, you know, that's what's so, I guess, hard about this is that, you know, here's two people and someone is trying to rob you. And that's kind of where my mind was at the time. I was thinking, this person wants to rob us. We have to give him what he wants, so he'll let us go. So I start offering him, you know, do you want a car? We have a car you could have. Do you want credit cards? Do you want me to go to the ATM? I'll get you money. Like, whatever you need, I'll get it for you. Because, you know, it was that thought of you, if somebody wants your purse, you throw it at them and run away. I was trying to give him what he wanted so that he would leave us alone and let us go. But he just kept saying no to all of our offers. And that's what seems so strange, is that he wasn't wanting what he said he wanted. So, you know, when I was like, I can get you money, I'll get you all the money you want, he didn't actually want money. And I think that's because his, you know, that's what he initially had said, but what he wanted all along was to hurt us. It wasn't to, you know, to rob us. And so, you know, he actually tied up our legs and gagged us. You know, and I just remember being so, I was afraid, but I felt an amazing peace over me this entire time. And I felt just that everything was going to be okay. And that was actually Chris's last words to me, was everything's going to be okay. And he ended up hitting Chris with a 52 pound rock. And you know, it seemed like a dream in my mind. I remember, I thought Chris got hit more than once. He only got hit once. And all I remember is Chris was gurgling, and I asked him to go turn Chris's head to the side because I didn't want him to choke on his own blood. And he actually went and did it. He wasn't that far away from me, but he went over to him and he came back over and he said, he's gone. Don't worry about him anymore. And so that's when he climbed on top of me. This is when I realized he was going to rape me. I don't think I thought about it until this moment. And so I was like, well, I'm going to fight him. Like, what do I have to lose here? So I tried to fight. I was screaming. I was trying to, you know, hurt him. And he stabbed me in my neck. And he said, look how easily I could kill you. And so I just stopped. And then he raped me. I don't remember being raped. I remember literally floating above my body. I wasn't feeling pain. I didn't feel, when he stabbed me in my neck, I did not feel any pain. And, you know, I was actually talking to him, and I was asking him, you know, about his family and telling him about my family. I was trying to have him put a name with my face. I was trying to, you know, let him know that I didn't want to die, and that I would help him. I was saying, I'll help you if you let me go. I'll never tell anyone what you did. I'll help you get away from here. You know, I was trying to befriend him so that he wouldn't hurt me. And I thought that I actually had befriended him. I had asked him to put my pants back on because I thought, right, well, if I die, I don't want to be found here naked. So I asked him to put my pants back on, and he actually did that for me. And I don't remember being hit, but I was hit in my face and in the back of my head. I was hit probably 5 or 6 times in my face and 5 or 6 times in the back of my head. I was not hit with the rock that he hit Chris with. I was hit with some kind of board. They never found what he actually hit me with. He hit me, and, I don't remember being hit, but I know that he did hit me. And then I think I played dead. I think I acted like I was dead so that he would leave and leave me alone. But I do remember thinking, I remember praying my last prayer because I thought, if I am going to die, I'm ready. And I felt that peace that I was talking about. I felt at peace that if I was going to die, it was okay. And I remember thinking when he left me there and when he walked away, I was thinking, thank you for leaving me here alive. And, you know, I got up. I don't know how much time passed. The 911 call was made at like 2:40 something in the morning. And I know that we went, got up to go back to the party around midnight. So there's like a 2 hour and 45 minute span in there that I don't know how long he was with us. I don't know, you know, when he, you know, left. I don't know how long I laid there before I got up to get help. But I walked about 200 yards to a house nearby, and they called 911 for me, and I was rushed to the hospital, and Chris was pronounced dead at the scene.
It's incredible, too. You talk about that you were conscious enough to say that I want to make sure I notice everything about him. You noticed he had a Mexican accent. You noticed things about his appearance. You noticed his black snake tattoo. You wanted to remember things because you said, you vowed to yourself, if I can get out of this, if I can get out of this, I'm going to get this guy. I'm going to help.
Right. I want to be able to recognize you and to get you if I have that chance.
Right. Now, your appearance, we haven't described your appearance, but it was amazing that you ran up to this building and there was four people living in this apartment that these guys had, and one guy was home. You walked in. Everybody thought, even your father later, thought you had red hair. But that was
right.
That's how much blood was caked in your hair. He broke the eye socket on your left eye, I believe, and broke your jaw, among other things, and lacerations. And you walked, like you say, you don't even remember. You walked on all kinds of glass and metal and rocks and everything to get to this house. Don't really remember that. Then you end up in the hospital. Tell us a little bit about just the first things that happened to you at the hospital after this, your treatment, who you encounter, because this is important to how the direction your life moves in as an advocate for abused people. Tell us about your experience
right.
at the hospital.
Well, I don't remember really a lot about the initial getting to the hospital. I mean, I remember riding in the ambulance with the ambulance a little bit. And then I don't remember like actually getting to the hospital, but I think the thing I remember the most in the hospital was the rape kit that was done on me because it was painful and it was awful. And, I just remember that, you know, as out of it as I was, I completely remember everything about that rape kit. I was in the hospital for quite a while before my parents actually got there, but they got there as fast as they could. I remember them even asking me for my parents' phone number when I was in the hospital, and I could not remember their phone number. That's how kind of out of it I was. But they did find my parents' phone number and called them. And it's crazy because when my parents actually got there, they met with the hospital counselor, and the counselor told them to not talk about what had happened to me and to try to not cry in front of me. Don't cause me any more hurt or trauma than they had to and that was the strangest thing because once I finally did see my parents and see my sister and my family got to the hospital, I thought it was so strange that nobody was talking to me about what happened and that, you know, when they would cry, they would literally like kind of walk away from me and try to go into the bathroom or go away from me when they were crying. And I'm just thinking, I was crying constantly and I was either sleeping or crying. That's pretty much all I was doing in the hospital. And it was, you know, I thought it was so strange that people weren't crying in front of me. And so I think that they were trying to, you know, help in that situation, but I don't think the advice really was correct. It was just that's what they thought that should be done, but it was a very awkward. It made things a little awkward, but in no way, you know, was I not supported. I mean, my parents and my sister and all of my sorority sisters, my friends, everyone, and Chris's friends, even everyone came and saw me in the hospital. And, you know, the hard part was I didn't get to go to Chris's funeral. I was still in the hospital when they had Chris's funeral. Right after the funeral, they brought me things from the funeral to the hospital. And, you know, that was just hard that I wasn't actually able to be there. But it was amazing the support that I got. And that's what's, you know, I think that that's what's always been amazing about my healing process and how I've been able to do what I've done is that my support system. It's been unreal. I've had, you know, amazing support from friends and family, support from strangers, support from anybody that you know, has heard my story. They've become, helped me in my healing. They've become part of my healing process. And so, you know, I if I could describe a perfect support system, it was mine, because, I mean, I never got the questions that I think victims get, especially when it's acquaintance rape or date rape, that they get, you know, what were you wearing that night? What, you know, questions about your choices. And so no one ever questioned me about my choices. No one, because I was hurt so physically bad that no one said, what were you wearing, or what, you know, what they couldn't, because I was hurt physically. And so I didn't get those normal questions that victims get. And I think that helped, and that I was constantly supported, and that everyone, you know, didn't ask me those questions, because I think I would have felt guilty, and I felt enough guilt. You feel guilt when things like this occur. You feel guilt. Nobody has to do anything. It's automatic that you feel this survivor's guilt. For me, I felt terrible survivor's guilt. And so, you know, I think that I attribute my healing, though, really to my support system. It still is amazing. I mean, I still have an amazing support system. I've always had one. And I think that's been how I've been able to do what I do today.
Let's talk about some of the parts of the recovery, but at the same time, meanwhile, they're, police are still just beginning to look for the search, because they don't have a name. They don't have a suspect. They have very little evidence other than your description. When you make the description, the sketch artist is really good. You say that really looks accurate, but it looks like a lot of people. There's a reward. It goes up to $20,000. They're doing everything they can. They're putting the DNA into databases, and there's no match. And you meet a central figure in your story as well. And in this book is Detective Craig Sorrell, and he almost immediately wants to know if you are interested in potentially participating in America's Most Wanted. So tell us a little bit about Detective Sorrell and some of the interviews he does with you, and sort of this his mission to have this case and have this killer apprehended.
Sure. Well, Detective Sorrell was, I mean, the perfect person to have handle my case, because I spoke to him actually in the hospital right after the attack. And, you know, he really asked just the who, what, when, and where, and why kind of questions. I mean, that's all he asked when I was, you know, in the most trauma and the most pain, like right after the attack. He just asked the basic questions that he needed to. And then, you know, he got my deposition later on, the full story of what happened, maybe 2 or 3 days later. And, you know, I think from that moment on, I always had the kind of relationship with him. And I think it started with that I got sick. I actually threw up on him when I first met him, and that kind of broke the ice. It helped to, you know, kind of start our relationship off, I guess, well. But, you know, we had kind of like a good rapport with each other. He felt like a big brother to me, almost, that he, you know, I really felt like he cared, and that he, you know, was treating me like he would one of his own family members. If something had happened to one of his own family members, that he was working that hard and wanting to figure out who had done this that badly. And so there were times when I felt like he wasn't working at all. And I would actually go to the Lexington Police Department and go and like meet with him to make sure that he was doing his job. But all along he was, you know, submitting that DNA and going after every lead that he could find. And there were so many leads, but we didn't have a suspect for almost 2 years. So for 2 years he was working and trying to figure things out. But I'm sure as that time was going on, he was probably losing some hope, because, you know, as time keeps going on, it's hard to, that makes it more difficult to, you know, solve the crime. And so, you know, I think he was submitting the DNA, doing what he could. You know, we didn't have fingerprints. All we had was DNA. So he submitted the DNA to a case in Texas. It was kind of a long shot. They had said that they thought the railroad tracks were, you know, the key in the case. And, he submitted the DNA, which he had done before. It wasn't like, you know, this was, he, I don't think he was expecting much. But it's like he submitted the DNA. They had, you know, a house that had been broken into in outside of Houston, Texas. A woman was killed, and her car was stolen. And they had DNA and his fingerprints, and the DNA matched. I mean, it was like amazing that the DNA matched, and we all of a sudden knew who it was because they had fingerprints. There was a suspect. I remember Detective Sorrell appearing at my apartment. I lived, I was in my fifth year in school, and I lived in an apartment at the off of the outside of the outside in Lexington, Kentucky. And so he came to my apartment, and he had never come to my apartment before. And I was going, something's not right, or something is strange. Why are you here? And he was like, you know, we have a suspect. This is who it is. He's going to be on America's Most Wanted in a couple of weeks. I want you to watch it. I want you to let me know if you think this is him. I never had to identify him because we had the DNA. It was 99.9% right. Sure that this was the guy. But I did watch America's Most Wanted, and they had footage of him defending himself in court. And when I heard his voice, because he changed his appearance a lot. He had a rap sheet going back to the 1980s. I mean, he had been arrested and sent back to Mexico. He was a Mexican illegal immigrant in the United States. And I mean, he had a long rap sheet, and they had footage of him defending himself in court. And I heard his voice, and I was like, oh my gosh, that's him. Because all I had to do was hear his voice. I knew that voice. I knew that it was him. I mean, I could have closed my eyes and known that it was him. I didn't need DNA to tell me that because I knew it was him. And you know, then it was all of a sudden there was a manhunt. There was going to be a manhunt for, you know, this person that they couldn't find then. And all of a sudden we had a suspect, and it was real. And the sad part was, is this was my worst fear in how I knew that we were going to solve the my crime, was that it was going to happen again. And that, you know, someone else was probably going to get hurt, get raped, possibly die. And unfortunately, that's exactly what occurred. And that's how we linked the crime, was that it happened again. And that was like my worst dream coming true, because I didn't want others to be hurt and for this to be happening again.
Let's talk about this fatal error. Doesn't matter who did it, but the fatal error is that while this manhunt was on, the INS was notified about information about this Renendez. So what happened with that information? And you talk about other murders. What happened as a result of this error?
So he actually, there was a manhunt for him, and I mean, he was put on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. I mean, it was pretty serious that they were trying to find this guy, because he was committing more murders, and he was, you know, killing more people, and his, you know, number of people that he had killed was going up, and so they really wanted to find him. And he actually, you know, was put on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, and he, you know, used to travel between the United States and Mexico all the time. And they stopped him at a border stop between Texas and Mexico. And they did not have the computers linked that would tell them that he was wanted for murder. And so they let him go. And, you know, it was a huge mistake. And he killed four more people after they let him go. So, you know, that not only did they let him go and there was that error, but, you know, and with errors like that, good things can come from that too, because that then the computer systems were linked. Hopefully that error will never, ever happen again. But, you know, four more people were killed after they let him go. So that was like a terrible error to happen, that they would, you know, let him go and he would then come back in the United States and kill more people.
You write that just weeks before the information was put into VICAP database, December 16, 1998, Dr. Claudia Benton, a pediatric neurologist researcher from Lima, Peru originally, was beaten to death and raped in her home in southwest Houston. Beat her with a statuette 19 times also stabbed her with a huge kitchen knife and also, unfortunately, raped her as she lay dying. Her head was found in a plastic bag and serious overkill. And this is part of another disgusting aspect of it. Before the killer left, he made himself a snack and opened up one of her daughter's Christmas presents and stole some souvenirs.
Right.
Tell us about what police do once they have him in VICAP and in short order, they're looking for him, but tell us what happens.
Well, you know, he was put on the FBI's most wanted list, and bounty hunters were definitely after him. Like that, there was lots and lots of people looking for him. And I think pressure was put on him by his family. He had a sister in the United States that actually had spoken with Detective Drew Carter,
right.
Drew Carter, and he was a Texas Ranger, and so this Texas Ranger had negotiated with Resendez's sister, and was trying to just negotiate his surrender, and so she ended up getting the reward money, which was fine with me because she did actually talk Resendez into surrendering. He actually drove across the border in a beat up old truck. I mean, I can't imagine sitting on the other side in Texas and thinking, why, you know, is this person even going to show up? Is this going to happen the way we think it's going to happen? I mean, it did happen exactly like they had planned. I mean, he drove in a truck, surrendered to Drew Carter, and was then flown to Houston. I mean, it was kind of unbelievable how the surrender occurred, considering all the carnage and people that he had killed and terrible things that he had done. The surrender actually went very simply, and you know, with the mistakes that had occurred, the surrender went simply, and he was then in custody, and you know, that it was over. The rampage was over.
The thing is that he did make statements, and so what do police get further information from him? What's his disposition about once he's already spent 10 years in prison off and on over the years with this extensive criminal record? So what is his attitude with police, and in terms of some people clam up, some people get a lawyer, what does he do in terms of police questioning?
Well, he couldn't afford a lawyer, so he actually tells the court system that he wants this to move as quick as possible. But he, of course, is given lawyers because he couldn't afford lawyers, so he was given lawyers. And, you know, they tried to convince him that he wanted to plead insanity, and that's so that's what he did. I think a lot of what he did was because others were telling him to. I think he really wanted things to go quickly and move fast and to, you know, have it all be over with. And I think it did move, I guess, pretty fast in the realm of trials and executions. I think he did end up pleading insanity. He was found sane. So, you know, but we had to go through all those parts of the trial then. So there was a trial on to figure out whether he was insane or sane. Then there was a trial and he was only tried on Dr. Claudia Benton's trial. He was never tried on the other 14 murders and my attack that he had committed. We never got our cases actually tried. He was only tried on Dr. Claudia Benton's trial. So, you know, that's kind of all it took, because it was, you know, not a speedy trial in any way, but it was, you know, it ended the way we wanted it to. And I actually did testify in the trial. I had to testify during the penalty phase of the trial. And they brought during the penalty phase, Texas, it was happening in Houston, and they could actually bring in all of the murders that he had been accused of. They could have everyone testify, all the family members, you know, myself. They brought in all those other victims' families and myself to testify. And so when I talk about the trial, that it literally was one of the worst days of my life. It was terrible. I was so afraid to face him again. I'm lucky that the prosecuting attorney, her name was Devin Anderson, and she was amazing in that she, you know, really took great care in questioning me. And it was, you know, that, I think that helped make it a little easier. And she told me, don't look to your left. I want you to only look at me. Your family will be behind me. Don't look to your left. That's where he'll be. And so I didn't. And, you know, I had never been in a courtroom before. I didn't know how things went. I cried through my entire testimony. I was so upset. But I did, I wanted to get through it. Like I said, I knew that I was waiting for that day. I wanted to get through that day. Whatever it took, I wanted to get through it. And so I testified, and he sat there stone cold. I didn't look at him until that point in the trial when they say, is the person who attacked you in the courtroom today? And I didn't know they really actually say that's for real. And I was like, yes, he's here. And they were like, could you please tell us what he's wearing? And so I actually had to look at him because I didn't know what – I had not looked at him. I literally had turned off my peripheral vision, and I had not looked at him. But he was sitting there, stone cold face, black eyes, like didn't have any emotion on his face after. And I mean, everyone in the courtroom was crying. Even the jury was crying. Like everybody was crying after my testimony. And he just sat there stone cold. And I said, he's wearing a white button down shirt. The defense didn't question me. I literally was taken out of the courtroom. I was about to faint. I mean, I felt my hearing going inside my head. I was going to faint. But they got me out of the courtroom in time. And, you know, that then the jury deliberated, you know, and the jury was sequestered for, I think it was around 3 months that they were sequestered. They weren't allowed to basically, you know, they had to stay in the same hotel. They had to not read any news. They had to basically shut themselves off from the world. And the only reason I know this is because one of the jurors wrote a book. And so he says that he was chosen for the jury because he didn't believe in the death penalty. And so he actually says that he was chosen for the jury because of that. And so, you know, when I testified, he says that my testimony helped him change his mind, that this person could get the death penalty and that he did deserve it because he had caused so much heartache and so much just hurting people, not only the victims, but the families, all the people that loved all those victims that he had killed. And he was given the death penalty. It was, you know, the ultimate price for his crimes. And he even, when he was given the death penalty, he wanted that to hurry up. He was like, all right, you gave me the death penalty, like, let's go. Like he was ready to kill me now. You know, but there was an automatic appeal. It was, you know, it turned into a kind of a long process because, again, the Mexican consulate got involved because they don't have the death penalty and whether he surrendered correctly or not. I mean, a bunch of questions were raised, and I think it had nothing to do with him. I think if he had had his choice, he would have, you know, said, give me the death penalty right now. Because I think he was done. I think he, you know, didn't want to be in the world anymore. Like he was done. He had, he didn't want to go to jail. And so, but he ended up, I guess, being in jail and, you know, with all of his appeals that occurred, he was executed in June of 2006. So he is not in the world anymore, and he was executed. And I feel safer today because he is not in the world. And I think I was able to heal more and in a different way because he's no longer in the world anymore. I don't have to worry that he's going to get out and come and get me, or that he, you know, he's going to – they're not normal. They're not like – things that probably would actually ever happen, but I still feel, I felt those things. I felt like he could get out and he would come and get me. And you know, that I was living in fear, just because he was still in the world. And I think that that's what went away when he was executed.
You talk about his behavior behind bars wanting to speed up the death penalty process in part. It sounded kind of a little misguided, but he was admitting to other and helping to verify other victims and other bodies and places where he had buried them and such. You say that the links got up to, that they'd linked him to 15 deaths, even though he had confessed to 20. So they verified 15 murders in total, brutal murders.
That's right. That's right. They didn't verify, I guess, some of them. They never got enough information to verify them. And, you know, to this day, there still could be more, and I think that there probably could be that we just don't know about. But they did link him to 15 that we know of today.
And we're talking about a pastor named Norman Cernick and his wife found dead in bed, their heads bashed in by a sledgehammer from their tool shed. That was another hallmark. He would improvise with a weapon that he found at the scene. Raped and sodomized. This was Pastor Skip's birthday, his 47th. Incredible cases against vulnerable widows, older people, not that it's good anybody's young or old, but he's some of the MO and his signature was to pick very vulnerable people. And so part of to dismiss his insanity, I mean, it is absurd to think that he didn't know right from wrong. They had all kinds of things where he had planning. He used cunning. He picked vulnerable people. So they dismissed that insanity defense completely, didn't they, despite the experts that testified at trial?
That's right. I mean, you know, that is what insanity is. It's if you know the difference between right and wrong. And I think that they very much proved that he did know the difference between right and wrong. And
sure. Yeah,
I think somebody has to be somewhat crazy. And I think there's a difference between insane and crazy. But I think that there has to be something wrong with your mind to be able to kill 15 people, that there's something not right. And so I do believe that he had something not right, that something was definitely wrong. But I do believe that he was saying that he knew the difference between right and wrong. He knew what he was doing. I mean, he asked for forgiveness before his execution. He knew what he was doing was wrong. And so that's, you know, he proved that again and again.
But he was attempting to toy with the media, telling them this story that he was half angel, half human, and other religious mumbo jumbo to somewhat give this insanity defense some credibility. But at the same time, there were letters to his common law wife that just seemed to be totally sane and just about mundane topics. So sort of
discrediting. Yeah, and you know, I really think that part of why he was doing that, the trying to kind of get some notoriety, was that he was trying to maybe possibly make money for his common law wife, and he had a daughter that you know was born, and I mean I believe that he was probably trying to, you know, make money for them. And so his mom testified during the trial that she had dropped him on his head when he was a baby and things like that I'm just, and people are like, doesn't that make you mad? And I'm like, I'm now a mom, like I understand if this was my child, I would try to explain something that I had done to cause this person to be this way. Like, I get it now. I mean, now that I'm a mom, I understand why she did that and why she feels like it's her fault, because you can't, you know, rationalize how you raised your child and that this is your child now that's doing these horrible things. I've got a lot more empathy, I think, and grace for his family and, you know, people that loved him and what they have now gone through. I think he just caused a lot of heartache all around. It wasn't just with his victims and their families. It's his family. I mean, it's a lot of heartache. And you know, it was all caused by him.
We have to get back to where your process for overcoming this trauma to a degree that you could go back to school and focus and get on with your life. And we did skip over I'm sorry, but we missed this fateful meeting with Jacob Pendleton back in 1998. So just tell us briefly about this meeting and sort of what happened before we can later fast forward to what happens later, the good parts of your life.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, I think my life was pretty great after – when I went back to school, it was really – 1 month later, and it was because I felt normal at school. I needed to take back some control, and control for me was going back to school. I also don't know how my parents let me do that now that I know, you know, what I know. But they did let me, and I went back to school, and I felt normal at school. It felt good to be back in control and to be living my life. And I actually dropped all my classes that year except for one because I couldn't, you know, I'd missed a month of school. I couldn't keep up. But I kept one class, and so I was bored. And so I got a job, and I got a job at an outdoor store. My friend, my sorority sister helped me get that job. And I met this young man while I was working. He was in the ski department. I was a cashier. And his name was Jacob. I didn't know him before the attack. And so I was a little afraid to kind of get in a relationship with him. But luckily, you know, my sorority sister had worked at that store for a long time. So she had, you know, those were her friends. And she had told them about what had happened. And they all knew about what had happened. And, you know, I think it was a very normal relationship for, you know, what it could have been. I think there was a lot more nights that I cried. There was a lot of, you know, in crying and being upset, but it was a very normal relationship. And I think that that felt good too, that I could get, you know, back into, I could trust someone and get into a relationship that I felt safe in. And I did feel very safe in it. There was, you know, a breakup around the year anniversary of the attack. That's the story of Jacob and I is a long one, a very drawn out story. But you know, today I actually am married to him. So it's a 20 year story of, you know, some breakups, some, getting back together, some, you know, times of dating, not really, you know, getting along very well sometimes. But you know, we've been married now 13 years this year, and
wow.
You know, he's an amazing guy. Like, he has been through my entire healing journey with me. I mean, he was there, you know, I met him basically 2 or 3 months after the attack. So he was there through all of my healing. He has been there. He, you know, has supported me through all of my healing. And so I couldn't ask for a better person to have in my corner to support me and to, you know, basically let me heal how I need to, because that's what he does. He, you know, doesn't try to fix me. He lets me do what I need to do. And, I think that that's why our relationship works so well. You know, that, and I talked before about my support system, and I think what's been amazing for me in my healing has been being able to talk about what happened. I was asked
Sure.
2 years after, or about a year and a half after the attack, to do some public speaking. And I thought, this is crazy. Like, I can't do public speaking. I don't like public speaking. That was my worst class in college. Like, this is not something I can do. But she was like, it's a safety talk. You know, you could talk about your experience. And I'm like, you're crazy. Like, I don't know anything about safety. And then as I thought about it some more, I was like, well, if I can give them some awareness by telling them my story and telling them what happened, then I can do something. And so, you know, I started doing a safety talk, and people were listening, and I really was just talking. That's what I do. You know, I'm not a professional speaker today. Even I'm not a professional speaker. I just talk. I just tell you my story. And that's, you know, what I've always done, but it's so healing for me. It's so healing for me to talk about it. It loses its power over you. The more you can talk about it, the more it loses its power. That's why today I can talk about it and not cry and not get upset. It's lost its power over me. I'm now living this life that is free from all that anger and revenge and feelings of hate and all those feelings that are bad. I've let those go. I've let those go with my attacker. They're his fault. They go with him. I've let them go, and I can live this happy life. I choose to live this happy life, this, you know, life of helping others and to, you know, do what I can to try to help other survivors in their healing. And you know, that's been kind of my mission, is that, you know, I got a lot of healing from other survivors. I seeked out survivors' books. I wanted to read them. I wanted to know that I wasn't going crazy, that what I was feeling was normal, that other survivors were going through this too. And so I got a lot of power from hearing from other survivors, and a lot of power in my healing, hearing from other survivors. So I think that that's a big reason why I wanted to, you know, help, why I want to help others, is because I got so much from other survivors.
Not only the influence of Detective Sorrell and Texas Ranger Carter, but also another police officer with a vision Brian Turpin, gets together with you after his wife hears one of your inspirational talks. You become quite a prolific and sought-after speaker, and so he has an idea for something bigger to unite some of the services and some of the things you think that are missing when people want to report, and they come up with a vision. So tell us a little bit about the vision and what happens and what the work did you do to try to secure a building. Tell us a little bit about this transformation
sure.
to get to Holly's House.
Yes, we worked for over 4.5 years to develop Holly's House. Brian Turpin called me on the phone. He said, you know, he called me up and I was working for my dad at the time. I was doing exactly what I was planning to do, working for my dad, you know, kind of working my way up in his company. That was what I was going to do. But Brian Turpin called me and he says, you know, I heard you, my wife heard you speak, and we're really wanting to start an advocacy center in Evansville, and we think you should be involved. And I thought, I had to Google what an advocacy center was because I had no idea, but it so made sense. So what an advocacy center is a safe reporting location for victims of crime. So, you know, it's a safe place that they can come. They don't have to go to the police department. They can come and they can be interviewed in a one interview process, and it's safer. It is more admissible in court. It helps get more perpetrators in jail. It helps victims. And so, you know, as I realized that, I'm like, I would love to be involved. And he's like, okay, well, we'd like to name it after you. And I thought, well, if you're going to name it after me, I might have to be a little more involved than we might need to partner up here. So we did. We partnered up. We worked 4.5 years to get Holly's House opened. We were determined to open Holly's House as a nonprofit. We wanted to open 100% debt-free. And so we were constantly talking to the community and anyone that would listen to try to support us in our efforts to get Holly's House started. So we talked to the Building Trades Commission, and we had secured a building we had to secure our building. It was an old library that we secured through a lot of talk and proposition. We actually, you know, got that library donated to us. And then we had to get the labor donated to us to be able to renovate the building. So we met with the building trades, and they all got on board to renovate the building for us, and all the labor unions got involved, and they, you know, did all the work with their apprentices to get Holly's House renovated. And so we opened in 2008, in September of 2008, and we opened 100% debt-free. And we are a child and an adult advocacy center, so we serve children victims as well as adult victims, and we give them a safe place to report that crime happening. And then we've also, furthered our services in that now we try to help prevent these crimes from happening. We teach a program in our local schools called Think First, Stay Safe, and we try to prevent these types of, you know, especially child sexual abuse, child abuse from happening. And so it teaches kindergarten through fifth grade children the lures that predators use to try to make them victims. And so, you know, we want to prevent these crimes from happening. And Holly's House serves the local, our community in Indiana, Southern Indiana, Evansville, Indiana. But we also serve our surrounding counties. And there are advocacy centers like this across the United States. There's child advocacy centers across the United States. So they're in many people's communities, and you may not even know what they're doing, and you hopefully never have to go to one, because if you do have to go to one, it means that a child has been abused and that they need to be interviewed. It's the thing in your community that you hope you never have to use, but then when something like this happens to your loved one, it is the most amazing organization to have in your community, because the process would be so much more difficult without that advocacy center in your community. And so that's, you know, that was a missing piece in our community, and it was a labor of love and a lot of tears to get Holly's House open. It was not easy, but you know, it is an amazing resource for our community.
You talk about stepping down as the executive director, a lot of stress, and then realizing that all this responsibility, you still had to take care of yourself, and then some really, really happy news happened. Tell us about the births of your sons.
Sure. So I actually left Holly's house, and we were in the adoption process. We were suffering from infertility, and so we were actually in the adoption process, but simultaneously we were doing fertility treatment, so it's like we were going to get a baby one way or another. And so we ended up, after our fertility treatment, we ended up pregnant, and it was after 7 years of infertility, and we ended up being pregnant with our son, who's now 5 years old. And I mean, it was the greatest gift that I've ever been given. I mean, I didn't even know how much I wanted to be a mother till I had him. And it was like my greatest dream come true. I didn't know that your heart could be outside of your body like that, that you could love something so much. And you know, his name is William Christopher, and we named him, William Christopher, and Christopher is after Christopher Meyer, my boyfriend that was killed. So he has a very special name. And he actually has a bear that was made, with a pair of Chris's favorite jeans. My friend Adrian actually had a stuffed bear made from a pair of Chris's jeans. So he has, you know, that bear. He doesn't know, right? I mean, he knows a little bit now that he's five. He knows kind of who Chris is. I don't think we keep pictures of Chris in our house, and we definitely keep his memory alive. I don't think he really realizes, you know, that he knows he's named after him, but I don't think he knows exactly who he is. I think he knows he's in heaven and that he's not in the world. But you know, he doesn't really know why. And that's, you know, that, and we actually have another son now as well. We, did that whole fertility process again. And so now we have our two boys, and you know, our lives are complete. We're done having children now, but our two boys are probably the greatest gift and the most amazing things in our life. So,
it's an amazing, uplifting book. We didn't even go into a lot of the incredible adventure when the police, you cooperate with America's Most Wanted and John Walsh, and it aids in the capture and it helps, and just the incredible national interest in this story and you in particular. And so it was, we just touched on a little bit of that. I want to thank you very much, Holly Dunn, for coming on and talking about Soul Survivor, the inspiring true story of coming face to face with the infamous railroad killer. It has been my pleasure, and thank you very much. For those that might want to find this book, or do you have a Facebook page or a website, is there any way people might contact you or look at other work?
Sure. So the book website is just soulsurvivorbook.com, and that's S-O-L-E, survivorbook.com. And they can go to that website and learn more about me. I'm also on all the social media outlets as Holly K. Dunn. So I do have a Facebook page and Instagram, and Twitter. So I can be found definitely on the social media sites. And, you know, I love to hear from my supporters. I love to hear from the people that have helped me get to where I am today. So now you guys all listening, and you guys are all part of my healing process too. And so that, you know, that's every time I tell my story, I have, you know, the people that are part of my healing process.
Well, thank you very much. It's been an uplifting interview for a change. Pretty rare on the True Crime program.
Thank you.
So thank you very much, and have a great evening. Thank you very much for this interview.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Take care. Bye.
Good night.